for. Forby's leg hurt for a couple of days. Otherwise, manumission left his life unchanged. But he really was becoming inefficient as a beggar. A strong, healthy youth does not draw the alms that a skinny child can. Often Baslam would have Thorby place him on his pitch, then send him on errands or tell him to go home and study. However, one or the other was always in the plaza. Baslam sometimes disappeared, with or without warning. When this happened, it was Thorby's duty to spend daylight hours on the pitch, noting arrivals and departures, keeping mental notes of slave auctions, and picking up information about both traffic's through contacts around the port, in the wine shops, and among the unveiled women. Once Baslam was gone for a double 9 day, he was simply missing when Thorby woke up. It was much longer than he had ever been away before. Thorby kept telling himself that Pop could look out for himself, while having visions of the old man dead in a gutter. But he kept track of the doings at the plaza, including 3 auctions, and recorded everything that he had seen and had been able to pick up. Then Baslam returned. His only comment was, "Why didn't you memorize it instead of recording?" "Well, I did, but I was afraid I would forget something. There was so much." "Hmph." After that, Baslam seemed even quieter, more reserved than he had always been. Thorby wondered if he had displeased him, that it was not the sort of question Baslam answered. Finally, one night, the old man said, "Son, we never did settle what you are to do after I'm gone."
"Huh? But I thought we had decided that, Pop. It's my problem."
"No, I simply postponed it. Because of your thick-headed stubbornness. But I can't wait any longer. I've got orders for you, and you are going to carry them out."
Now, wait a minute, Pop. If you think you can bully me into leaving you..."
"Shut up. I said after I'm gone. When I'm dead, I mean. Not one of these little business trips. You are to look up a man and give him a message. Can I depend on you? Not goof off and forget it."
"Why, of course, Pop, but I don't like to hear you talk that way. You're going to live a long time. You might even outlive me."
"Possibly. But will you shut up and listen? Then do as I tell you."
"Yes, sir."
"You'll find this man, it may take a while, and deliver this message. Then he will have something for you to do, I think. If he does, I want you to do exactly what he tells you to. Will you do that also?"
"Why, of course, Pop, if that's what you want."
"Count it as one last favor to an old man who tried to do right by you, and would have done better, had he been able. It's the very last thing I want from you, son. Don't bother to burn an offering for me at the temple. Just do these 2 things. Deliver a message, and 1 more thing. Whatever the man suggests that you do."
"I will, Pop," Thorby answered solemnly.
"All right, let's get busy."
The man turned out to be any one of 5 men. Each was a skipper of a starship, a tramp trader, not of the 9 worlds, but occasionally picking up cargoes from ports of the 9 worlds. Thorby thought over the list. "Pop, there's only one of these ships I recall ever putting down here."
"They all have, one time or another.
It might be a long time before one showed up."
"It might be years. But when it happens, I want the message delivered exactly."
"To any of them, or all of them?"
"The first one who shows up."
The message was short but not easy, for it was in 3 languages, depending on who was to receive it, and none of the languages was among those Thorby knew. Nor did Baslam explain the words. He wanted it learned by rote in all 3. After Thorby had stumbled through the 1st version of the message for the 7th time, Baslam covered his ears.
"No, no! It won't do, son. That accent!"
"I'm doing my best," Thorby answered sullenly.
"I know. But I want the message understood. Sheha, do you remember a time when I made you sleepy and talked to you?"
"Huh? I get sleepy every night. I'm sleepy now."
"So much the better."
Baslam put him into a light trance. With difficulty, as Thorby was not as receptive as he had been as a child, but Baslam managed it, recorded the message in the sleep instructor, set it running, and let Thorby listen, with post-hypnotic suggestion that he would be able to say it perfectly when he awakened. He was able to. The second and third versions were implanted in him the following night. Maslam tested him repeatedly thereafter, using the name of a skipper and a ship to bring each version forth. Maslam never sent Thorby out of the city. A slave required a travel permit, and even a freedman was required to check in and out. But he did send him all over the metropolis. 3 9 days after Thorby had learned the messages, Maslam gave him a note to deliver in the shipyard area, which was a reserve of the Sargon rather than part of the city.
"Carry your freedman's tag and leave your bow behind. If a policeman stops you, tell him you're looking for work in the yards."
"He'll think I'm crazy."
"But he'll let you through. They do use freedmen as sweepers and such. Carry the message in your mouth. Who are you looking for?"
"A short, red-haired man," Thorby repeated, "with a big wart on the left side of his nose. He runs a lunch stand across from the main gate. No beard. I'm to buy a meat pie and slip in the message with the money."
"Right." Thorby enjoyed the outing.
He did not wonder why Pop didn't view phone messages, instead of sending him a half-day's journey. People of their class did not use such luxuries. As for the royal mails, Thorby had never sent or received a letter, and would have regarded the mails as a most chancy way to send a note. His route followed one arc of the spaceport through the factory district. He relished that part of the city. There was always so much going on, so much life and noise. He dodged traffic, with truck drivers cursing him and Thorby answering with interest. He peered in each open door, wondering what all the machines were for and why commoners would stand all day in one place doing the same thing over and over. Or were they slaves? No, they couldn't be. Slaves weren't allowed to touch power machinery except on plantations. That was what the riots had been about last year, and the Sargon had lifted his hand in favor of the commoners. Was it true that the Sargon never slept, and that his eye could see anything in the nine worlds? Pop said that was nonsense. The Sargon was just a man, like anybody. But if so, how did he get to be Sargon? He left the factories and skirted the shipyards. He had never been this far before. Several ships were in for overhaul, and two small ships were being built, cradled in lacy patterns of steel. Ships made his heart lift, and he wished he were going somewhere. He knew that he had traveled by starship twice, or was it three times? But that was long ago, and he didn't mean traveling in the hold of a slaver. That wasn't traveling. He got so interested that he almost walked past the lunch stand. The main gate reminded him. It was twice as big as the others, had a guard on it, and a big sign curving over it with the seal of the Sargon on top. The lunch stand was across from it. Thorby dodged traffic pouring through the gate and went to it. The man behind the counter was not the right man. What little hair he had was black, and his nose had no wart. Thorby walked up the road, killed a half hour, and came back. There was still no sign of his man. The counterman noticed the inspection, so Thorby stepped forward and said, "Do you have Sunberry Crush?" The man looked him over.
"Money?"
Thorby was used to being required to prove his solvency. He dug out the coin. The man scooped it up, opened a bottle for him.
"Don't drink at the counter. I need the stools."
There were plenty of stools, but Thorby was not offended. He knew his social status. He stood back, but not so far as to be accused of trying to abscond with the bottle, then made the drink last a long time. Customers came and went. He checked each on the chance that the red-headed man might have picked this time to eat. He kept his ears cocked. Presently the counterman looked up.
"Are you trying to wear that bottle out?"
"Just through, thanks." Thorby came up to put the bottle down and said, "The last time I was over this way, a red-headed chap was running this place." The man looked at him.
"Are you a friend of a red?"
"Well, not exactly. I just used to see him here when I'd stop for a cold drink.
Let's see your permit."
"What? Well, I don't need—" The man grabbed at Thorby's wrist. But Thorby's profession had made him adept at dodging kicks, cuffs, canes, and such. The man clutched air. The man came around the counter, fast. Thorby ducked into traffic. He was halfway across the street and had had two narrow escapes before he realized
that he was running toward the gate, and that the counterman was shouting for the guard there.
Thorby turned and started dodging traffic endwise. Fortunately, it was dense. This road carried the burden of the yards. He racked up 3 more brushes with death, saw a side street that dead-ended into the throughway, ducked between 2 trucks, down the side street as fast as he could go, turned into the first alley, ran down it, hid behind an outbuilding and waited. He heard no pursuit. He had been chased many times before. It did not panic him. A chase was always 2 parts. First, breaking contact. Second, the retiring action to divorce oneself from the incident. He had accomplished the first. Now he had to get out of the neighborhood without being spotted. Slow march, and no suspicious moves. In losing himself, he had run away from the city, turned left into the side street, turned left again into the alley. He was now almost behind the lunch stand. It had been a subconscious tactic. The chase always moved away from the center. The lunch stand was one place where they would not expect him to be. Thorby estimated that in 5 minutes or 10, the counterman would be back at his job and the guard back at the gate. Neither one could leave his post unwatched. Shortly, Thorby could go on through the alley and head home. He looked around. The neighborhood was commercial land, not yet occupied by factories, jumble of small shops, marginal businesses, hovels, and hopeless minor enterprise. He appeared to be in back of a very small hand laundry. There were poles and lines and wooden tubs, and steam came out of pipe in the outbuilding. He knew his location now, 2 doors from the lunch stand. He recalled a homemade sign, Majestic Home Laundry, Lowest Prices. He could cut around this building and, but better check first. He dropped flat and stuck an eye around the corner of the outbuilding, sighted back down the alley. Uh-oh, 2 patrolmen moving up the alley. He had been wrong, wrong. They hadn't dropped the matter. They had sent out the alarm. He pulled back and looked around. The laundry? No. The outbuilding? The patrol would check it. Nothing but to run for it, right into the arms of another patrol. Thorby knew how fast the police could put a cordon around a district. Near the plaza, he could go through their nets, but here, he was in strange terrain. His eye lit on a worn-out washtub. Then he was under it. It was a tight fit, with knees to his chin and splinters in his spine. He was afraid that his clout was sticking out, but it was too late to correct it. He heard someone coming. Footsteps came toward the tub, and he stopped breathing. Someone stepped on the tub and stood on it.
"Hi there, Mother." It was a man's voice. "You been out here long?"
"Long enough. Mind that pole. You'll knock the clothes down."
"Is there anything of a boy?"
"What boy?"
"Youngster. Getting man tall, fuzz on his chin, breech clout, no sandals."
"Somebody," the woman's voice above him answered indifferently, "came running through here, like his ghost was after him. I didn't really see him. I was trying to get this pesky line up."
"That's our baby. Where'd he go?"
"Over that fence and between those houses."
"Thanks, Mother. Come on, Juby."
Thorby waited. The woman continued whatever she was doing. Her feet moved, and the tub creaked. Then she stepped down and sat on the tub. She slapped it gently.
"Stay where you are,"
she said softly. A moment later, he heard her go away. Thorby waited until his bones ached, but he resigned himself to staying under that tub until dark. It would be chancy,
as the night patrol questioned everyone but nobles after curfew, but leaving this neighborhood in daylight had become impossible.
Thorby could not guess why he had been honored by a turnout of the guard, but he did not want to find out. He heard someone, the woman, moving around the yard from time to time. At least an hour later, he heard the creak of ungreased wheels. Someone tapped on the tub.
"When I lift the tub, get into the cart fast. It's right in front of you."
Thorby did not answer. Daylight hit his eyes. He saw a small pushcart, and was in it and trying to make himself small. Laundry landed on him, but before that blanked out his sight, he saw that the tub was no longer nakedly in the open. Sheets had been hung on lines so that it was screened. hands arranged bundles over him, and a voice said,
"Hold still until I tell you to move."
"Okay, and thanks a million. I'll pay you back someday."
"Forget it," she breathed heavily. "I had a man once. Now he's in the mines. I don't care what you've done. I don't turn anybody over to the patrol."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"Shut up."
The little cart bumped and wobbled, and presently Thorby felt the change to pavement. Occasionally they stopped. The woman would remove a bundle, be gone a few minutes, come back and dump dirty clothes into the cart. Thorby took it with the long patience of a beggar. A long time later the cart left pavement. It stopped, and the woman said in a low voice,
"When I tell you, get out the right-hand side and keep going. Make it fast."
"Okay, and thanks again."
"Shut up."
The cart bumped along a short distance, slowed without stopping, and she said,
"No."
Thorby threw off his covering, bounced out, and landed on his feet, all in one motion. He was facing a passage between two buildings, a service way from alley to street. He started down it fast, but looked back over his shoulder. The cart was just disappearing. He never did see her face. 2 hours later, he was back in his own neighborhood. He slipped down beside Baslam.
"No good."
"Why not?"
"Snoopies. Squads of them."
"Arms gentle, sir. You swallowed it. Arms for the sake of your parents."
"Of course."
"Take the ball."
Baslam got to hands and knee, started away.
"Pop, don't you want me to help you?"
"You stay here."
Thorby stayed, irked that Pop had not waited for a full report. He hurried home as soon as it was dark, found Baslam in the kitchen washroom, paraphernalia spread around him, and using both recorder and book projector. Thorby glanced at the displayed page, saw that he could not read it, and wondered what language it was. An odd one. The words were all seven letters, no more, no less.
"Hi, Pop. Shall I start supper?"
"No room. No time. Eat some bread. What happened today?"
Thorby told him, while munching bread. Baslam simply nodded.
"Lie down. I've got to use hypnosis on you again. I've got a long night ahead."
The material Baslam wanted him to memorize consisted of figures, dates, and endless three-syllable nonsense words. The light trance felt dreamily pleasant, and the droning of Baslam's voice coming out of the recorder was pleasant, too. During one of the breaks, when Baslam had commanded him to wake up, he said,
"Pop, who's this message for?"
"If you ever get a chance to deliver it, you'll know. You won't have any doubts. If you have trouble remembering it, tell him to put you into a light trance. It'll come back."
"Tell whom?"
"Him. Never mind. You're going to sleep. You are asleep."
Baslam snapped his fingers. While the recorder was droning, Thorby was vaguely aware once that Baslam had just come in. He was wearing his false leg, which affected Thorby with dreamy surprise. Pop ordinarily wore it only indoors. Once Thorby smelled smoke and thought dimly that something must be burning in the kitchen and he should go check. But he was unable to move, and the nonsense words kept droning into his ears. He became aware that he was droning back to Pop the lesson he had learned.
"Did I get it right?"
"Yes. Now go to sleep. Sleep the rest of the night."
Baslam was gone in the morning. Thorby was not surprised. Pop's movements had been even less predictable than usual lately. He ate breakfast, took his bowl, and set out for the plaza. Business was poor. Pop was right. Thorby now looked too healthy and well-fed for the profession. Maybe he would have to learn to dislocate his joints, like Granny the snake, or buy contact lenses with cataracts built into them. Mid-afternoon, an unscheduled freighter grounded at the port. Thorby started the usual inquiries, found that it was the free trader Sisu, registered home port, Newfoundlandia, Shiva 3. Ordinarily, this would have been a minor datum, to be reported to Pop when he saw him. But Captain Krausaw of the Sisu was one of the five persons to whom Thorby was someday to deliver a message, if and when. It fretted Thorby. He knew that he was not to look up Captain Krausaw. That was the distant future, for Pop was alive and well. but maybe Pop would be anxious to know that this ship had arrived. Tramp freighters came and went, nobody knew when, and sometimes they were in port only a few hours. Thorby told himself that he could get home in 5 minutes, and Pop might thank him. At worst, he would bawl him out for leaving the plaza, but shucks, he could pick up anything he missed through gossip. Thorby left. The ruins of the old amphitheater extend around one-third of the periphery of the new. A dozen holes led down into the labyrinth, which had served the old slave barracks. An unlimited number of routes ran underground from these informal entrances to that part which Baslam had preempted as a home. Thorby and he varied their route in random fashion and avoided being seen entering or leaving. This time, being in a hurry, Thorby went to the nearest, and on past, there was a policeman at it. He continued as if his destination had been a tiny greengrocer's booth on the street rimming the ruins. He stopped and spoke to the proprietress. "Howdy, Inga. Got a nice ripe melon you're going to have to throw away?"
"No melons."
He displayed money.
"How about that big one? Half price and I won't notice the rotten spot."
He leaned closer.
"What's burning?"
Her eyes flicked toward the patrolman.
"Get lost."
"Raid?"
"Get lost, they said."
Thorby dropped a coin on the counter, picked up a bell fruit and walked away, sucking the juice. He did not hurry. A cautious reconnaissance showed him that police were staked out all through the ruins. At one entrance, a group of ragged troglodytes huddled sadly under the eye of a patrolman. Baslam had estimated that at least 500 people lived in the underground ruins. Thorby had not quite believed it, as he had rarely seen anyone else enter or heard them inside. He recognized only two faces among the prisoners. A half hour later, and more worried every minute, Thorby located an entrance which the police did not seem to know. He scanned it for several minutes, then darted from behind a screen of weeds and was down it. Once inside, he got quickly into total darkness, then moved cautiously, listening. The police were supposed to have spectacles which let them see in the dark. Thorby wasn't sure this was true, as he had always found darkness helpful in evading them, but he took no chances. There were indeed police down below. He heard two of them, and saw them by hand torches they carried. If Snoopies could see in the dark, these two did not seem equipped for it. They were obviously searching, stun guns drawn, but they were in strange territory, whereas Thorby was playing his home field. A specialized speleologist, he knew these corridors the way his tongue knew his teeth. He had been finding his way through them in utter blackness twice a day for years. At the moment, they had him trapped. He kept just far enough ahead to avoid their torches, skirted a hole that reached down into the next level, went beyond it, ducked into a doorway, and waited. They reached the hole, eyed the narrow ledge Thorby had taken so casually in the dark, and one of them said,
"We need a ladder." "Oh, we'll find stairs or a chute."
They turned back. Thorby waited, then went back and down the hole. A few minutes later he was close to his home doorway. He looked and listened and sniffed and waited until he was certain that no one was close, then crept to the door and reached for the thumb hole in the lock. Even as he reached, he knew that something was wrong. The door was gone. There was just a hole. He froze, straining every sense. There was an odor of strangers, but it wasn't fresh, and there was no sound of breathing. The only sound was a faint drip, drip in the kitchen. Thorby decided that he just had to see. He looked behind him, saw no glimmer, reached inside for the light switch, and turned it to dim. Nothing happened. He tried the switch in all positions. Still no light. He went inside, avoided something cluttering Baslam's neat living room, on into the kitchen, and reached for candles. They were not where they belonged, but his hand encountered one nearby. He found the match safe and lit the candle. Ruin and wreckage. Most of the damage seemed a sort that results from a search which takes no account of cost, aiming solely at speed and thoroughness. Every cupboard, every shelf had been spilled, food dumped on the floor. In the large room, the mattresses had been ripped open, stuffing spilled out, but some of it looked like vandalism, unnecessary, pointless. Thorby looked around with tears welling up and his chin quivering. But when he found, near the door, Pop's false leg, lying dead on the floor with its mechanical perfection smashed as if trampled by boots, he broke into sobs and had to put the candle down to keep from dropping it. He picked up the shattered leg, held it like a doll, sank to the floor and cradled it, rocking back and forth and moaning.